Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
The government currently has a proposed rule that they have taken the comments on. That's only the breeding sector and in a large part, a lot of the dairy sector that's being impacted by that. And that's the government saying we need that for that sector.
NCBA President Todd Wilkinson.
I'm saying that America's beef producers, our cattle producers, need to voluntarily go beyond that and be able to identify their herds so that I know when my animals go into market, I can trace back, and I get all of that information. Most importantly, I know that my herd is not going to be quarantined under something, and it's going to be able to continue to operate at the speed of commerce.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We talk about the cattle cycle, and yes, you can paint this in as a part of a cycle, but we know that 10 years ago we had a low that was driven by drought, so it was an exaggerated low, if you will. We're in that even more so now.
Dr. Darrell Peel, Oklahoma State livestock economist.
Obviously, drought is the reason why we've liquidated so hard the last, now 3 years. And so, it is an unusual time. And if you just want, if you want superlatives, I mean, the beef cow herd, given what USDA has told us in these new numbers, is the smallest since 1961. And the total cattle inventory in the U.S. is the smallest since 1951. So we haven't been this small in a long, long time in this industry.
And he says when it comes to the loss in numbers, it's really driven by drought.
Drought is the major driver of how we got here. But I think there's a number of other factors that play into sort of where do we go from here or how fast are we going to go somewhere different. I think we're smaller than we need to be. I mean, beef production is going to decline again in 2024 and probably 2025. The market will make use of that. We'll probably wind up pricing a smaller supply even higher, but it means some people won't eat as much beef because we won't have as much beef. So I say all that to say that I think, broadly speaking, we're smaller than we need to be as an industry. There's plenty of market support out there for us to be a bigger industry. So I think we are going to try to rebuild when we get a chance. But that process is going to play out a little bit different, I think, from this point on, just given where we are and how we got here.
But did we learn lessons from the drought 10 years ago?
One of the differences this time from 10 years ago, and I think this comparison to that last situation is very valid because it's very strong in producers' minds, and I think it has a lot to do with how their expectations are forming. And that drought, as you said, was so centered in the southern plains, Texas, Oklahoma, and spilling out around the edges of that. It drove the national numbers, but it was very confined. And as a result of that, the rest of the industry actually was poised to sort of recoup from that much quicker. This drought, it's moved around, and long-term droughts tend to do that. So it really started in 2020. 2021 was mostly in the northern plains. 2022, it moved back in the central plains and southern plains. 2023, it was kind of all over the place. And at the end of 2023, it was in the Delta region pretty seriously and still is to some extent. So I say all that to say that I think this last several years has affected a lot wider set of producers. And so it's a different process to recover from that than when a few producers are more severely impacted. This is a much broader based kind of an impact, and it's going to be a little bit broader based process to recover from.
So could we start seeing rebuilding of the herd regionally?
The way I've been looking at the numbers for a while, and I'll rerun them with these new USDA numbers, but I don't think it's going to change very much. Looks to me like the best we can hope for in 2024 would be to sort of hold stable. Stop liquidating, so stop getting smaller. That's good. And in fact, that's not uncommon. If you look at cattle cycles historically, they kind of have a flat spot on the bottom. They typically have a flat bottom there where there'll be 2 years that aren't very much different, and then you start regrowing. But the way I look at it this time, 2024, flat to, and depending on what drought does, could continue liquidation, but the best we could hope for would be flat. Limited potential to growth and to grow in 2025. So I think we're talking about an extended process before we could really ramp up to a faster pace of expansion.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Tony, we have worked with our farmers in our state very closely over the course of, the last 2 years almost now.
Christy Seiferts with the American Soybean Association on Farm Bill Priorities.
So we started our own internal Farm Bill process back in 2021 with sending out a survey to our farmers across the 30 primary soy producing states. We held our own series of virtual listening sessions, 12 virtual listening sessions across soy country, 25 hours, gathered a lot of input, packaged those into Farm Bill priorities that were released a year ago. And we've been working to promote those all over the Hill and with others ever since. We know that budget is critical in the Farm Bill process. And unfortunately, we are in a really challenging budget situation right now to navigate with debt ceiling and what may or may not impact agriculture there. And then, of course, the Farm Bill budget to be determined whether, we have a flat budget scenario, a budget cutting scenario, or a budget increase scenario like we did back in 2002 when we wrote the 2002 Farm Bill under Chairman Combat's leadership. You know, I think budget is going to really help us have a better idea of what is possible. But not knowing what that budget number is, I can tell you the needs in agriculture are very real. For ASA, we heard loud and clear that the farm safety net, the Title I farm safety net has to be improved, especially for soy. We lived through the worst case scenario in the last few years with the China trade war. You know, we lost our largest export market for a period of time and hardly triggered the ARC element of Title I and didn't trigger the PLC element of Title I. And boy, when you just look at the other economic disruptions we've lived through in the last few years, but also the volatility that's ahead potentially, you want to prepare for disruption. You want a stronger safety net in place. So we've promoted the need to improve Title I farm programs, especially related to ARC and PLC for soybean growers. But we've also promoted some other priorities. Of course, protecting crop insurance is a big one. It's the most effective, most important part of the farm safety net that we've got to protect against harmful amendments that could arise in the Farm Bill process. We want to make sure that crop insurance remains effective, that it remains affordable, that it continues to be a public-private partnership of program delivery. And then I think one other area I'll highlight, there are many, of course, but one more area is trade promotion programs. Knowing that we've lived through the China trade war, the disruptions there, knowing of the volatility globally, we'll never be able to replicate China as a market. They are enormous, not just for soy, but for other U.S. ag products. We want to make sure that we are also growing and expanding trade market opportunities globally. So if we are able to have increased investment in trade promotion programs like MAP, like FMD, that can help us, it can help others in agriculture put our eggs in more baskets and help us longer term.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
It's a great opportunity for us to come together with the beef industry and share their concerns, share our concerns, and collaborate. Because really, when you talk about the work that we do, it's really a partnership with the cattle industry to really maximize that value opportunity back to the supply chain in general.
Dan Hallstrom, President and CEO, U.S. Meat Export Federation at CattleCon 24. What about MAP and FMD?
The industry, the beef checkoff and pork checkoff, for that matter, investments in our industry and in USMEF are extremely important. And what we do is we, over the years, we've been able to leverage that with government dollars, the market access program, MAP, and the foreign market development program, FMD. And this really makes the producer dollars go further in opening up and developing these markets around the world.
But can you really open a market without being there?
Yeah, being in the market, being involved in the market, it's no different than business here. You would never do business with someone that you don't know, right? Or at least not normally, so... I think that's key. Having a presence, of which we have offices in, 19 regions around the world, about 100 employees outside the U.S., and that complements all the industry offices that are around the world each and every day. So that's what really having that personal relationship, having that personal communication is what helps to build a market over time. And as this last year on beef and pork in 2022 was a record at $19.5 billion of exports. So, I think it's proven that it works pretty well.
But with these high prices, are we getting rid of demand, export demand?
The buyers around the trade, I say buyers, it's really the trade around the world, whether it's Japan or a Korea or a Singapore or a Mexico, they're very savvy. They know the markets. They know that droughts happen. They know that prices go up and prices go down. They also know that supply goes up and down. It's part of the cycle. And they're well aware and have been now for a couple of years that we're going into a down cycle on supply. So for the last 2 years, we've been, as has the industry, been very integrated with these customers, talking about, hey, the next few years are going to be tough, so we need to talk about some other options. You're not going to have enough short plates in Japan because production is down 5% this last year. And they get that. So their first question is, what are the other alternatives? This is the beauty of the situation, making a stressful situation into a constructive one by saying, well, maybe you can use some of the round, the knuckles, the inside, some of the more underutilized parts of the carcass. And this has been extremely effective. It's not ideal. They'd rather have 5% more plates, but it is what it is. And they know that eventually we'll come out of that. So this is the time when we're in the downside of the cycle to go ahead and try to create new supply chain channels with new products. And then when we come out of the situation where we do have more production, there's more options for our customers globally.
So are we seeing long-term demand building over demand destruction?
I do think that's the goal, and I think we've done that. Maybe not in every market around the world, but in a lot of them. I would say that we're in a period of demand construction. And the reason I say that is, I'll give you an example. Mexico and Central America this past year, which have actually been up markets for U.S. beef, It wasn't that long ago where when products reached a certain price, they stopped buying. Well, that was not the case this last year. They kept buying U.S. beef, whether the choice cutout was 270 or 305. So that tells me places like Mexico, Guatemala, places that were very, very price sensitive just 4 or 5 years ago, are now starting to understand the value involved of the quality.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
If you dig into the heifer data that we have, and really it's more recent.
Oklahoma State livestock economist Darrell Peel.
For about 22 or 3 years now, USDA has been giving us, within that replacement heifer number we get every year, they've been giving us a breakout of the subset of those heifers that are bred. And what becomes important there is you can say, well, those are two-year-old heifers, coming two-year-old heifers, right? So they're from the calf crop 2 years ago. And then if you subtract the bred heifers from the total, what's left are heifers that we're calling replacements, but they're heifer calves from last year's calf crop. So we're working with two different sets of heifers here. And I say all that to say that when you start trying to follow through time those different sets of heifers, and then you look at how many heifers are going to calve this year versus how many we said we were keeping to breed last year, it's obvious in the data that what happens is that there's a fair number of producers that didn't call them replacement heifers, but we have feeder heifers or stocker heifers out in the country, and they wind up getting bred. And so I call it impulse heifer breeding, as opposed to the ones that were planned going into the thing. And I've been digging into this data a lot more because I'm very interested in this process of how we're going to recover from the current situation. And what I find is that typically, or at least in the last cattle cycle, there was a big jump in that impulse breeding in the early stages of expansion. The guys that were planning to breed were slowly building their heifer inventories, but a bunch of other guys jumped on the bandwagon to facilitate that more rapid herd expansion. And then those were the ones that quit doing it at the top. So they were, you know, they, and so I say all that to say that I think what we're going to see here, the USDA data tells us we're not bringing very many bred heifers or heifer calves into 2024. But what we might see if expectations change and if Mother Nature facilitates a better prospect for us, we might see a sizable jump in this impulse breeding, where a lot of heifers that are out there right now that they're stockers or they're feeder cattle or maybe not not spoken for yet, and they might wind up getting into the breeding pool, and so that would be the place where we could start this quicker.
What should we keep our eye on for the rest of this year? Maybe imports and exports?
Well, you know, the imports and exports started in 2023 to behave as I would expect, honestly, in the current market conditions. I mean, we had record beef exports in 2022, and we expected in 2023 they would start to fall, and they did. But we're in a tighter beef supply situation. Prices are higher, and on top of that, we've had a strong dollar most of the time. So those are three headwinds for exports. By the same token, as beef production falls in the U.S., and particularly as cull cow slaughter drops, when we don't have to liquidate and try not to to cull as many cows, that's one of the bases for stopping liquidation, then our processing beef that supports our ground beef market that's so important in the U.S., and so that becomes much more attractive. Prices are higher, so we start importing more beef. And we're seeing that. I think it'll probably continue as we go forward. It doesn't change. I mean, none of those are – they're at the margin. So none of those are changes that – overwhelm or offset what's going to happen in the U.S. industry, but they modified it a little bit around the edges in terms of, you know, and it really comes down to how much our consumers impacted. If we import a little more beef, then there's a little bit less pain for consumers with reduced beef production in the U.S. If we export a little less, we keep a little bit more of what we are producing that's smaller in the domestic market. So it's really moderating it from a consumer standpoint as much as anything.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
At the end of the day, the most important thing to any producer out there, and I would say to anybody who's a processor too, but in particular just sourcing the raw materials, so it is on the producer's side to go ahead and produce these things, to move things through the pipeline, ultimately through those who need to procure it, is the math.
Bob Maurer, Manduka Trading, Chicago.
That's got several factors that have to be input in order to figure that out. Number one is just the board, and, you know, is there going to be some profitability once you filter through all the expenses that are typical, right? Sometimes you get atypical years like what happened through COVID and some other events that'll knock some of those longer term tendencies in terms of the inputs, such as pesticides and herbicides and nitrogen and those things, for a loop one way or the other, right? And that could kind of skew the math a bit. But if you just kind of look at the long term and you just deal with the, you know, average way that you kind of calculate the math relative to those crops you can actually produce on the land that you were either blessed with through generations of the family or newly went and invested in, you know, you need to figure out whether there's going to be profitability, and that could change based on what the prices do in the marketplace. And it's not easy, right? I mean, at the end of the day, you have to make a decision because you have to buy the seed and you have to get it in the ground, and you made your decision, then it's a done deal. In the meantime, you're waiting for, you know, some solid data in terms of what your expectations are for all those, you know, costs of production, shall we say. And then you also kind of need to think about what the government's going to do in terms of the programs it has and how that might influence the math at the end of the day also. So it's not an easy decision. I mean, from my perspective and from those who are my peers and colleagues that I've known over the decades in this industry, you know, this is the crunch time. You know, you crunch the numbers and just try to make the best decision. And I believe that at the moment it seems to be favoring corn, but then again, to your point, all of a sudden you see corn prices slide back down after it tried to rally for about a week or two there, and you wonder, you know, is that going to be the best decision? And then you kind of look at soybeans and maybe wheat and see if those are more of a sideways market. Maybe the math work out a little bit better then. But, you know, there's a forward-looking element to this, and that is you need to buy your seed, right? And everybody's going to be thinking the same thing at the same time, and you need to lock that in and make the decision ultimately before the prices move around. So I don't know if I really answered your question, but I think net-net, it is kind of a harder decision. There's not just one commodity that's really a marquee or sitting up there towards, you know, pointing to the top right of the chart, shall we say, pushing towards the top right of the chart. That's kind of going to give you kind of like a confidence edge in terms of being able to make money. We'll see how things line up, you know, as those who need to make that decision ultimately make that decision. And, you know, I think next month, definitely the month, you know, in about 2 months, you're going to have to make that decision, and we'll see how it plays out.
And another aspect of beans?
The March soybean crush, as inferred by prices and published by the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the crush had been somewhere in the, say, 160s and almost 170 back in those months when the markets were rallying, July and August. And now we touched just on the 26th, which was Friday, a price of 74 and three quarters. So it broke in about half in, you know, that 7-8 month time frame. And really, there is demand for the crush in terms of one of the products, that being the bean oil, because expectations are for pretty good demand. Global veg oil production this year is expected to be about up 3.2 million metric tons. Consumption should double that if it comes in. That's at least what Oil Words saying, coming in at about 7.5 million metric tons. So net, need a lot of oil, but don't need the meal. So we'll see how that kind of works its way into prices.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
2023 was a very good year on pork.
Dan Hallstrom, President and CEO of the U.S. Meat Export Federation, on pork and lamb exports.
We're not at a record. We will be a record on value, probably not volume, probably be the second largest year ever on volume. But we're going to be $8.2 billion in exports, which will be a record once we get the December data next week. And it's broad-based growth. It's not just one market. You've got Mexico set a record on pork in October with 2 months to go. Central America is going to set a record, led by the Guatemalas, Nicaraguas, El Salvadors of the world, Panama. But there's other, you know, Philippines in Southeast Asia. You look at, you know, I already hit Central America, but you look at Japan. Japan had a rough year on beef, but on pork we were up a little bit. So this is the beauty of the situation, is that even though food service is struggling, and it was struggling on pork as well, we still had a fairly good year into the major countries like Korea and Japan on pork. So, yeah, I think not only is 2023 shaping up to be a really good year, but 2024 is looking pretty promising as well going forward.
But with so many headwinds for the industry, is he pessimistic or optimistic?
No, I'm optimistic. I think if you look at the base supply and demand situation globally, there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic. And, you know, I'll mention a couple regions. Southeast Asia, the ones I just mentioned. Southeast Asia shows immense capacity for increasing pork today and also beef, but down the road even more so. These middle classes will keep expanding. The spending power will keep expanding over time. I mean, there'll be ups and downs, but over time, the spending power is going to increase. We haven't even talked about Africa. You know, 1.5 billion people and the youngest demographic on the planet. That's another part of the world that, and I'm not talking about just Egypt, but I'm talking about Angola, Nigeria, Benin, Gabon, South Africa. There's many, many places in Africa that will be on the radar. And if you say in 5 to 10 years' time, when you're sitting here talking to whoever kicks me out and wants to do this job, I said, you're going to be talking a lot about Africa, because that young demographic is going to get into the spending power category in the next 3 to 5 years.
But have we fully recovered from problems with infrastructure and supply chains? Any concerns on transportation?
We had a real test of the supply chain post-COVID in 2020. So that hopefully that's an anomaly we'll never have to go back to. But if you look at certain regions of the world, yeah, we have continuing supply chain concerns. Gaza, Israel, and the Red Sea area stands out. And while that's relatively new in terms of the disruptions, you know, that Red Sea area for distribution through Europe, Africa, South of Europe, can be impactful. Not that we sell that much product there, but these supply chains are global. They make a loop. You know, you don't just go within Africa. They go around the world. And so eventually, if this goes on for any length of time, there will be some implications. And when you have disruptions, or they start, for now, instead of going through the Red Sea, going all the way around the Cape, you know, through South Africa back up, you know, that not only does that add cost, but inefficiencies into the system. So we need to keep an eye on it. To answer your question, yeah, it's always on my mind, but as long as there's no global disruption like COVID, I think it can be dealt with relatively easily.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
More farmers are turning to direct marketing of their goods and commodities as both a way to engage with consumers and meet changing demands from such. And as Chad Hart of Iowa State University Extension points out, driving that outreach are younger farmers and ranchers, several of whom are trying to create their own niche within a family farm operation.
It's always been a game where for the farmer you wear many hats. But it used to be one of those hats was not, I have to worry about connecting with the consumer. Now it definitely is.
It's also not just about growing demand domestically.
Because when you're looking at our production, the idea is that we produce more than enough to meet our own needs, plus we depend upon selling to the rest of the world. So we're not only trying to adjust to how our consumers here within the U.S. are adjusting, but how they're adjusting internationally as well.
Examples of direct marketing range from roadside farm stands to farm-to-school or government product sales. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.